Okay, it's a pleasure to be here tonight amongst learned friends. My wife and I had a magnificent time at the last Border History Teachers Network dinner last year, and I had no hesitation when Ron asked me to give the keynote for tonight's presentation, so very happy to be here. Confucius, communism, and the bomb. North Korea lends itself to sexy presentation titles. So let me probe the title I've given this presentation in more detail. Confucius. The Korean Peninsula remains under the influence of a strong Confucian tradition dating back to the 14th century. This influence is evident in the family-based personality cult surrounding the North Korean leadership, as well as in the cultural customs of both Koreas today. These political and cultural traits stem from the Confucian social hierarchy based on age and deference to one's elders. What about communism? This part of the title refers to North Korea's political system, a uniquely Korean adaptation of communist dictatorship imported from Stalinist Russia in 1945. It's uniquely Korean because of the combination of Soviet totalitarian institutions with a strong influence of Confucian customs. Or to put it another way, the Korean leadership is less Dr. Strangelove and more akin to the philosopher kings of Lord of the Rings. One could argue that this is a key reason why the Kim regime is still in power, long after the rest of the communist world has collapsed or integrated itself with Western capitalism. But there's another reason why North Korea survives as a 20th century ideological throwback. The title mentions the bomb, another shorthand borrowing from Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. The North Korea of the last two decades has become synonymous with nuclear weapons proliferation. I'm going to argue this evening that the bomb, North Korea's nuclear weapons program, has been integral to the survival of the North's unique brand of communism, because it performs a number of functions in the political economy of the North Korean state, pardon me, over and beyond its obvious military purposes. In making this case, I'll begin by sharing some of my own experiences with the Hermit Kingdom and identify other sources of information about happenings inside North Korea. I'll then talk about the rationality of North Korea's provocative behaviour and suggest how Pyongyang's recent provocations make sense in the context of a leadership working to ensure its survival. Of course, I couldn't speak to a gathering of history teachers without talking about some history. So I'll describe how the grinding inefficiencies of the communist system, in combination with natural disasters and the Soviet collapse, led the North Korean leadership to rely on nuclear weapons development as its primary survival strategy. And finally, I'll outline the various ways the nuclear program aids the Kim regime in its efforts to perpetuate itself. How do we know what's going on in North Korea? I get asked this question all the time, and it's a good question. It's not for nothing that North Korea is known as the Hermit Kingdom, an isolationist totalitarian state shielded by an impenetrable information blockade, the embodiment of George Orwell's 1984. However, information does leak out, both indirectly and directly. Piecing this information together is like completing a jigsaw. You can't see the whole picture without assembling all the separate pieces, a process that makes the study of North Korea both incredibly challenging and immensely interesting. All of the disparate information sources have certain biases and limitations. None on their own provide an adequate picture of the whole. We have to filter, cross-reference, and corroborate these various sources to correct the bias, to separate the wheat from the chaff, and paste together the broader tapestry. So where do we get these pieces of information? News is often smuggled out by third parties and published in online media. While online, of course, we can monitor physical changes to the landscape and infrastructure of North Korea using Google Earth, which has become a very powerful research tool. Insights into the North Korean economy can be gleaned from what we call mirror statistics, like the trade data of countries such as China, South Korea, and Thailand that do business with the North. We get information from the testimony of North Korean defectors who've escaped to South Korea or the United States. Now, this data is not without its problems, as defectors sometimes embellish their stories or resort to outright fabrication to boost their chances of gaining political asylum. Nonetheless, the verified stories of those people who've risked everything to escape North Korea can be a rich source of information about what's going on inside North Korea. There are also many foreigners that visit North Korea, like the gentleman in the picture here, not me. This gentleman was from the border city of Dandong, where I taught English for a while. Now, by night, he was an English language student of mine. By day, he was a businessman, a trader, who sold his wares on the other side of the Yalu River in North Korea, in the town of Sinwaeju. And he had many interesting stories to tell me about what was going on inside that town. Many Westerners work in-country in North Korea, with government or with non-government organisations, I should say, like UNICEF or the World Food Programme. A small but growing number of people visit North Korea as part of their business ventures. And of course, there's people like me who visit North Korea as tourists. So now to my experiences with North Korea. In July 2008, I went on a tour to the city of Kaesong, just north of the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, which is the narrow strip of neutral land separating north and south. I was in one of the last tour groups to go on this tour. It was suspended after a South Korean woman was shot by North Korean border guards at a tourist resort at Mount Kumgang, one of two North-South joint venture projects in North Korea. What you see on the slide here is a section of the other North-South joint venture project, the industrial precinct outside of Kaesong, just north of the DMZ. The Kaesong Industrial Park is the flagship of the South's efforts to engage with North Korea. In this precinct, South Korean companies have set up factories to manufacture their wares while taking advantage of cheap North Korean labour. The North Korean government benefits from the project by taking a 50% slice of workers' wages, which are not that high, believe it or not. On any tour of North Korea, visitors are accompanied at all times by a government chaperone, a trusted member of the party. These officials make sure you go where you're supposed to go and don't see, photograph, or talk to anyone that you're not supposed to see. On one occasion on the Kaesong trip, I got hassled out by some party officials for walking away from the main group to go to the toilet. Now, while perhaps not an offence worthy of the gulag, I was nonetheless very aware that my every move was being watched. On our departure back through the DMZ, North Korean customs officers examined every photo saved on visitors' digital cameras to check that nothing sensitive had been photographed. This gives you an inkling as to how the regime attempts to keep its citizens trapped in an information bubble. But this is a walk in the park compared with the social controls that ordinary North Korean citizens have to deal with every day. To cite a few examples, North Korean citizens must participate in regular self-criticism sessions. Yeah, they're not that funny in real life. They can't discuss politics in any way beyond the parroting of official ideological dogma. They can't travel outside of their neighbourhood of residence without official permission. Their employment, education, and even survival prospects in tough times are dictated by their party affiliation and official class designation. Breaking the rules can often lead to disappearance to prison camps or much worse. Collective punishment is also used. Whole families and friend groups can be imprisoned for the transgressions of one individual. Just bear with me, I'm a bit croaky tonight. One of the highlights of the Kaesong tour was a visit to this Buddhist shrine up in the hills above the city. Now, can anyone tell me what's wrong with this picture? Yeah. Nothing visually wrong with it. Well, North Korea is a communist state where religion is outlawed. So what's the purpose of taking Western visitors to see an outlawed shrine? Well, there's a pretty simple answer to that. It's a crude propaganda device appealing to an audience in the international community, offering the pretense of religious tolerance and respect for human rights. Although most people, though, are aware that human rights tends to fly under the radar in totalitarian North Korea. In fact, there's much about the way the North Korean government presents itself that is a mirage. The town depicted here on the slide is the village of Kijongdong on the northern side of the DMZ. Indeed, the trees you see in the foreground lie within the 4 kilometre wide, heavily mined strip of land separating the two Koreas. Kijongdong is also known as the propaganda village because the buildings you see are hollowed concrete shells. They're there to demonstrate North Korea's prosperity and thus the superiority of the communist system. Now this is funny, of course, because we know it's a sham. You'll also notice the large flagpole. A similar one was built previously on the South Korean side of the DMZ. Not to be outdone, the Northerners erected one that was a third larger than the structure on the South Korean side, again to demonstrate North Korean superiority. I have to say it was disturbingly phallic. You'll also notice the mountains in the background, totally devoid of trees. Now, because of the ongoing chronic energy shortages after 1991, North Korean citizens have logged most of the woodlands in the country for fuel. And you can understand why when the temperature in winter often heads south at minus 20 degrees. Indeed, the DMZ is the most militarised frontier on the planet today, with thousands of troops and an even larger number of missiles and artillery batteries aligned against each other across the 38th parallel. In the picture here is the peace village of Panmunjom, in the middle of the DMZ, where North and South Korean troops stare eye to eye. The actual border between North and South is represented by the small concrete strip between these two blue buildings. Inside these buildings are conference rooms where military and civilian delegations from both sides meet periodically to manage the tense border standoff. You might remember news footage of Julia Gillard in one of these buildings during her visit to Korea a few weeks ago, with North Korean soldiers peering at her through the window. Now, while gunfire is exchanged from time to time in Panmunjom, this place was the scene of a music war in the 1980s, when loudspeakers on the North Korean side bled stern communist anthems across the dividing line. The Americans upped the ante and responded with Michael Jackson. It's more common today to see visiting tourists gawking at the angry-looking border guards from both sides of the divide. Beyond the blue sheds on the North Korean side of this photo, you can see a group of tourists who would have entered North Korea on a chaperoned tour from China. And they take it in turns on each side to go into one of these blue sheds. In 2004, I worked as an English teacher in the Chinese city of Dandong, which is in Liaoning province in China. Dandong is a small frontier city of 1 million people on the west bank of the Yalu River, across from North Korea. The picture on the slide shows the adjacent North Korean town of Sinwaeju on the east bank of the Yalu. The contrast between the two towns and the relative prosperity of the two countries was most stark at night. On the Chinese side of the river, the Dandong waterfront was lit up like a Christmas tree, while Sinwaeju was invisible, cloaked in darkness. Dandong is also the primary border crossing point and trade artery between China and North Korea. On the left of the slide is the heavily guarded road and rail bridge into North Korea. This rail line goes all the way to the North Korean capital of Pyongyang. On the right are the remnants of the old bridge between the two towns, the Broken Bridge, as it's known locally, which was destroyed by American bombers during the Korean War. Not content, of course, with blowing up the major bridges across the Yalu River during the war, American General Douglas MacArthur proposed a plan to drop 26 atomic bombs along the Yalu River frontier to lay a strip of cobalt, as he described it, to prevent the Chinese from sending troops to support the North. Fortunately, President Harry Truman declined MacArthur's request and eventually removed him from command of US forces in the Korean theater. Take it in. Let's move on now to contemporary events. The popular theory floating in the public imagination is that North Korea is an out-of-control state ruled by a madman. And many of you will be familiar with this image of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il as a psychopathic puppet in the movie Team America. This is emblematic of that madman image. Now, no doubt the North Korean state is insular and dysfunctional. It has a reprehensible human rights record, and its foreign relations are characterised by repeated provocations, deliberate pinpricks that risk an all-out escalation of war. But let's clarify something right away. An aggressive North Korea is not the same thing as an irrational North Korea. Its behaviour is predictable when you look at it from the perspective of regime survival, of a dictatorship looking to maintain a crumbling political system in the face of a hostile neighbourhood, a chronically inefficient economy, and repeated natural disasters. North Korea's nuclear program is rational in response to adverse circumstances. Its many provocations against South Korea and the United States are tactical manoeuvrings of this response. And while they might not be all that wise, they are far from the random acts of a sociopath. Having said that, though, it's fair to say that the North Korean regime has a habit of provocative behaviour. On the 9th of October 2006, North Korea conducted its first nuclear test, detonating a small device underground in the country's mountainous northeast. The international consensus was that this test was a dud. We should remember that exploding a nuclear device is a complex technical undertaking, a multifaceted process in which there is considerable scope for malfunction and error. Nonetheless, the test sent diplomatic shockwaves around the region and announced North Korea as a player in the nuclear club. If there was any doubt about this, it was removed on the 25th of May 2009, when a second underground test demonstrated the North's nuclear capability. As I speak today, the only ambiguity that remains is whether the North has the technical expertise to miniaturise its nuclear bombs into a device small enough to fit atop one of their many medium and long-range missiles. But of course, the provocations don't end there. On the 26th of March 2010, a South Korean Navy corvette named the ROKS Chunan sank in the Yellow Sea after a North Korean torpedo pierced its hull, killing 46 sailors. The Chunan was patrolling the southern side of the disputed northern limit line, a maritime boundary between North and South Korea in the Yellow Sea. As you can see in the picture, the Chunan was retrieved from the seafloor for forensic examination, which is how the South reached the conclusion that the North was behind the attack. Later last year, on the 23rd of November, North Korean forces on the mainland fired approximately 170 artillery shells and rockets at South Korean-held Yeongpyeong Island, hitting both military and civilian targets. The shelling caused widespread damage, killing 4 South Koreans and injuring 19. The South Korean military on the island returned fire on the North Korean artillery positions. And that's the vision that you can see here. The international community drew its breath after the Kim regime's second nuclear test in 2009. Wondering if a nuclear-armed North Korea would be a measured regional actor. The Chunan and Yeongpyeong Island provocations would suggest that the answer to this question is no. The more important question to ask, however, is why? To answer this question, we first need to delve into a little history. Today's national division is an aberration. Prior to 1945, Korea had been a single political entity for over 1,000 years. The road to division began with the Japanese annexation of Korea in 1910. Korea was occupied for the longest period of all the mainland Asian territories that fell to Japanese imperialism in the early 20th century. This was a traumatic period for Koreans. During the occupation, Korean males were conscripted into the Japanese Imperial Army. Korean females were pressed into service as comfort women or sex slaves. Both men and women were brought to Japan as indentured labourers. Japan used Korea as an industrial base for its expansion into Manchuria and China, as well as a source of food for the Japanese home islands. The occupation ended in 1945 with Japan's defeat in the Pacific War. Both the Russians and the Americans raced to take control of Korea as the war drew to a close. The division we know today, at the 38th parallel, was created by US General John Hodge, who out of expediency and ignorance drew a line through the map to delineate the areas of responsibility for the US-Soviet joint trusteeship of Korea. Through the late 1940s, the Americans and Russians both set up puppet regimes, which competed to become the legitimate government of a united Korea. This competition, of course, went hot in 1950, when North Korean leader Kim Il-sung ordered his troops to invade the South. Although there's some evidence to suggest that South Korean leader Syngman Rhee was keen on doing the same, going the other way. After 3 years of fighting and millions of deaths, the sides ended up exactly where they started at the 38th parallel. After the war, North Korean leader Kim Il-sung began reforming the North Korean state along Stalinist lines by collectivizing agriculture, taking over industrial facilities, implementing a centrally planned economy, and purging political rivals. Initially, this system enjoyed a period of success as the country rebuilt from the ruins of the Korean War. However, by 1970, the inefficiencies of the command economy began to be felt. Through the 1980s, the North became increasingly reliant on aid and subsidised trade from the Soviet Union to prop up its ailing economy. As we know, this house of cards fell apart in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Many of you will remember this iconic image of Russian leader Boris Yeltsin standing astride a tank after the aborted coup against Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, which led directly to the dissolution of the USSR. This event was a disaster for North Korea. After all, the North is a small country that's resource poor, that has no indigenous petroleum reserves of its own, and lacks the arable land base to adequately feed its population. During the Cold War, its mechanized agriculture and industrial economy were heavily dependent on inputs from the communist bloc. When the Soviet Union collapsed, however, these inputs ceased. The industrial sector ground to a halt. Agricultural output declined precipitously, which exaggerated food shortages that were already becoming apparent prior to 1991. By 1994, the country was in famine. State institutions were failing, and to top it off, the death of regime founder Kim Il-sung brought on a power transition at the worst possible time. The combination of the Soviet collapse, its isolation from the global capitalist economy, and a series of natural disasters led directly to the Great Famine of 1995-98, when approximately 600,000 North Koreans died of starvation and hunger-related causes. So as I previously remarked, Kim Il-sung, the great leader and the founder of the regime, died in 1994. His son, Kim Jong-il, rose to the leadership after two decades of careful grooming. Despite his long apprenticeship, however, the new leader needed to cement his power and stop the implosion of the North Korean state. And this is where nuclear weapons enter the equation. The obvious motivation for nuclear proliferation is for national security, to deter an attack by an adversary. North Korea can present a fairly convincing argument to justify its need for a nuclear deterrent. Given the forces arrayed against south of the DMZ, and over half a century of American nuclear threats. So remember the strip of cobalt comment. But, as I've just alluded, an American invasion was the least of Kim Jong-il's concerns in the late 1990s. After taking power, Kim Jong-il had a choice. He could try and prop up his father's failing institutional network, based around the Korean Workers' Party, or he could reorganise the state in a new way to consolidate his power. He chose the latter option, placing himself at the head of a new apparatus centred on the military. This new system privileged the military as the primary institution of the state and as the engine that would drive the country's economic recovery and thus safeguard Kim Jong-il's leadership. Now, it's in this context that we need to understand the North Korean bomb, because the nuclear program performs a variety of functions that help to prop up this military-first system. I've talked about the gaping hole left in the economy by the cessation of Soviet imports. Well, the nuclear program is the tool that Pyongyang uses to obtain inputs from the international community in order to cover this gap. It does so through the tactic of coercive bargaining, where it engineers crises in order to extract concessions from the international community. At forums like this one, the six-party talks in Beijing, many of the North's provocations need to be seen in this light, including nuclear tests, missile tests, nuclear threats, as well as the recent Chun'an and Yanpyeong Island incidents. North Korea can use this tactic because it's got all the leverage. The international community wants it to relinquish its nuclear program, but it has no credible military option, nor does it have sufficient economic leverage to compel North Korea's compliance. Also, neighbouring states fear the consequences of the collapse of the North Korean state because of the possibility of an enormous refugee exodus from the North, in the order of millions. They're willing to prop up the Kim regime with donations of aid to avoid this scenario. Now, some of you will be familiar with this photo. It's a nighttime satellite image of Northeast Asia, with a pitch black North Korea in the middle. This picture is a graphic illustration of the North's energy shortages. Of course, no energy, no lights. We also know that the North lacks sufficient food, fertilizer, and manufactured consumables to service its economy. And its government does not have the desire for the economic reforms necessary to obtain these goods on the international market. The purpose of coercive bargaining, then, of course, is to plug holes in the economy. It's not surprising that aid packages often include shipments of grain, fertilizer, and oil, as well as direct cash payments. That bottle of whiskey appeals to some. Now, while North Korea may be a dictatorship, absolute power does have its maintenance costs. In this respect, the nuclear program plays an important role in buying the loyalty of regime elites. Kim Jong-il is surrounded by a core of loyal supporters, which he's cultivated over a long period of time. The elite is essentially a network of clients whose loyalty he buys with imported luxuries and lifestyle comforts, which contrast vastly with the privations endured by ordinary North Korean citizens. So how's the nuclear program developed then? Aid payments made in cash are obtained through coercive bargaining, the fruit of its nuclear provocations. These payments are then reportedly funneled directly into a slush fund, which Kim uses to pay for his patronage network. Yet even if he wanted to, Kim Jong-il would find it difficult to shut down the nuclear program altogether. As a rule, every large institution has an inherent momentum towards self-preservation. And the North's nuclear program is likely no exception to that rule. For starters, there's the sunk cost of the physical infrastructure of the entire nuclear fuel cycle. And that includes reactors, mines, reprocessing and enrichment facilities, fuel fabrication plants, laboratories, and storage sites. All of these, of course, are scattered around the country. Then there's the people at work at these facilities. The main Yongbyon facility alone is thought to employ over 3,000 personnel. And specifically, it's the technicians and the scientists that are important here. If not for the nuclear program, where else would they work in North Korea? This is not a technologically advanced place at the moment. Without employment in the nuclear program, they're likely to be a flight risk. They and their detailed knowledge of the nuclear program would be a prize catch for American and South Korean intelligence agencies if they chose to defect. We also need to consider the large bureaucracy that oversees the nuclear program, stretching all the way up to the heights of the National Defense Commission, the country's peak military organ. It seems inconceivable, then, that the regime would choose to dismantle a program of such size. Finally, the nuclear program plays an important role in the ideological legitimation of Kim Jong-il's military-first system. During the famine, when the old ideologies of the state were largely discredited, one idea remained standing. Any guess? Anti-Americanism. Now, North Korean propaganda just isn't that subtle. We can see on this poster how the North Korean nuclear program comes into play. But it's also more complicated than that. By appealing to anti-Americanism, by positioning the nuclear program as the regime's tool for defence against the enemy, it legitimises the military's monopolisation of the state's resources and gives the people a justification for their privations. So without this, the military-first system would be far less stable than it otherwise is. There are also lessons here to bear in mind with other countries such as Iran that are attempting to develop nuclear weapons today. And the lessons are these. When it comes to nuclear weapons, capabilities do not always equate to intentions. And domestic political considerations are always as important as military and strategic ones. So in the Iranian case, one could mount a strong argument that President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, his nuclear posturing has as much to do with his factional battle for political power with Iran's religious establishment as it does with strategic competition with rival countries in the Middle East. My goal tonight has been to lay out the many reasons why North Korea has chosen to proliferate nuclear weapons. I've tried to emphasise the importance of domestic considerations in North Korea's nuclear policies and demonstrate how Pyongyang's provocations make sense in the context of regime survival. For the Kim regime, nuclear weapons are all about domestic survival. On the slide is a picture of Kim Jong-un, the current leader's youngest son and designated successor. It's all about keeping it in the family and preserving North Korea's unique take on communism. So thank you for your time this evening. It's been my pleasure to deliver this keynote address.
Ben, could I call upon our treasurer, who is looking at me, questions. So if anyone's got some questions, please, for Ben.
Ben, I'd love to know, in a thumbnail sketch, what do you think the future might be as China sort of develops the world, how she might sort of see... Is that a legacy of the past that she's going to move away from, or is the fear of that massive migration going to keep that sort of relationship? How do you think, I mean, I know you don't say I'm a China expert, but how do you feel she may sort of look at this situation, this sort of a little sort of situation for the North?
Yeah, that's a great question. On the one hand, North Korea is useful to China as a buffer state against the American military in Korea, so the Chinese don't want 40,000 American troops up on the east bank of the Yalu River. But on the other hand, they're getting sick of this, snotty little brother doing these outrageous acts that are jeopardising the whole stability of the region. And so they're gradually moving away from this alliance. So, in the Mao era, Mao talked of the alliance between North Korea and China as its closest lips and teeth. It's definitely not that close now. So if North Korea started a war, the Chinese would not be in on it. They'd be on their own.
I was taken with that graphic picture of the young children during the 90s.
Yeah.
To what extent was that famine inevitable in that, as you say, the country's been cut in two? Is famine an inevitability when perhaps the agricultural area career is elsewhere?
Yeah, well, while they had support from the communist bloc, they could make up for the shortfall they had. I mean, there's 30 million or so people that lived in North Korea, and always roll with the map when you're talking in international relations. So you can see how mountainous the country is. There's not all that much arable land to farm with. And in fact, prior to the division in the Korean Peninsula, it was the south that has more flat arable land, and that was the food bowl. And North Korea wasn't, for obvious reasons. So while they had partners in the communist bloc to get food in and to make up for the shortfall, that was all right, but once the Soviet Union collapsed and those inputs ceased, different story. And of course, if you're not willing to trade on the international market to buy food from the West, and let's face it, North Korea doesn't make anything to sell anyway, so they don't have the currency to buy on the international market, so they had very few options. Famine in that context was probably inevitable.
So what's sustaining their nuclear... I mean, where are they getting the funds from to sustain
it? You're partially from this coercive bargaining tactic. So whenever they get cash or aid or anything, actually, the military has first dibs on the resources of the state. So that any aid or cash or whatever or energy that comes in, military takes its cut, then divvies up the rest among the population. So they're a vast drain on the resources, and you can see the results for everyone else. That gets left behind.
Does this mean then that basically ending North Korea's nuclear weapons is a fallacy, really, and that we're really just going to continue to drip feed North Korea just to stop a crisis in terms of millions of refugees and just no one really? Is serious about removing those weapons. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. And it's not just the refugees. If North Korea collapses, what's going to happen? One thing, South Korea would expect that we'll reunite the country and take over. On the one hand, that makes them a new great power in the region. On the other hand, it's been estimated it'll cost something north of $1 trillion to the South Korean economy, so they're not that keen on that because, you know, they've rapidly become an economic power and it's not something they're keen to sacrifice. Another thing is, then you have China and the United States have to decide what's going to happen here. And it's not immediately clear if that process is going to be peaceful or not, especially in the broader context of US-China relations that may or may not get more bellicose. Does that answer?
Yeah.
That probably answers my question too. I was just wondering about his third son. He's been Western educated, I believe, and he's named on Facebook and Twitter and all sorts of things. Is there any hope that once his father dies that there might be something more, something might come out of it that may lead to some sort of cooperation?
Yeah, that's another interesting one. I think he was educated in Switzerland, from what I gather. And he's been out of the country and he's seen, you know, the communist system doesn't work. And he's seen the alternative. But if he's a designated successor, he has to try and make the system he's stuck with work. Now, it's also important to bear in mind, his father, before he took power, was groomed for 20 years. This guy is only 27, 28 years old, and he's been thrown in the fire with only 1 or 2 years of grooming. So it's not clear that he's been able to establish the networks of friends in high places in the key organs of the state that he needs to hang on to power. So one thought is that because the military is in charge, or the military in charge of the economy, is that the generals will form a military junta, something like Burma, and then the son will be a puppet figurehead of this military rule. But again, you'll know when it happens. Come on, students, fire up.
Thank you, Ben. Well, I think this musket, the Liqueur musket, has got a lot of gold medals on it. And I think it was very much a gold medal keynote address tonight. So I think, thank you very much, Ben.
We're really excited. Thank you very much.